Chris was kind enough to devote tonight's shiur to her mother. Tonight is her mother's yahrzeit, Shena Bluma Bas Menachem Mendel. So her neshama shtem aliyah. Thank you very much, Gladys. What we're going to be studying over the next 2 months or so is something which is, I think, a beautiful and poetic part of Judaism, which is the evening prayer, Maariv. And what I'm going to try to show tonight is that Maariv is really unique amongst the three daily prayers, Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, in terms of its origins. And we're going to do that through examining one central question, which is may come as a surprise because, you know, we tend to think of Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv as part of one unit. Just as Shacharis and Mincha are binding, we would say they're chova, they're obligatory. So too, you would think that Maariv was part of that same block. But what I'm going to try to show is that Maariv had a completely different origin in terms of its standing as either optional, rishus, or obligatory, and to show how this was a controversy that literally raged throughout the centuries. And as I'm going to show, it was such a controversy that people lost their jobs over it. You can imagine that, and not just anybody. So that's exactly where we're going to start. So if you take a look at the first source, the Mishnah has the following to say. This is the first Mishnah in the fourth chapter of Maseches Brachos. It's often the first Mishnah that students in today's curriculum in day school study. Certainly the first Mishnah that I studied in sixth grade. Jakey, you too? Okay. So it's a very nostalgic Mishnah for me. And the Mishnah says the following. Tfilas HaShachar Ad Chatzos, that the morning service, the morning prayer, can be prayed until the halfway point of the day. That's the majority view. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ad Arba Asha'os. But Rabbi Yehuda says you have a little bit of a shorter window, only until the fourth hour of the day. Tfilas HaMincha Ad HaErev. The majority view is that you can pray the afternoon service, Mincha, until evening. And Rabbi Yehuda once again has a shorter window, Omer Ad Plag HaMincha, until some point in the afternoon, but not all the way until the evening. Then we have the statement that we're going to focus on today. Tfilas ha'erev ein la keva. An unchallenged statement in the Mishnah is that the evening service, tfilas ha'erev, from where the word mariv, or as they like to say in Israel, arvit, comes from, ein la keva. Does anybody want to venture a translation of ein la keva? What does the word keva or kavua mean in general?
It's fixed.
Right, exactly. So J.K., you would argue that ein la keva would mean, therefore,
there's no fixed time for saying.
Exactly. That in J.K. said it perfectly. In the context of this Mishnah, which discusses timing, Shacharis has a certain rigid timing, and Mincha has a certain rigid timing. By the way, subject to a disagreement between the majority and Rabbi Yehuda in both cases. But unlike those two instances, Maariv does not seem to have a fixed time. We know that it should probably take place sometime during the night. It would be a little funny to say you could do it at 11 a.m., but it would seem that the language of Ein La Keva connotes a certain flexibility as far as timing is concerned. And that's our first hint, and we're going to turn towards the Gemara in just a moment, the Gemara's interpretation of this statement. But that's our first hint that Maariv is a little bit different. Unlike Shacharis and Mincha, which have fixed times, it seems like Maariv, the evening service, is just much more flexible. Ein la keva. And then the Mishnah goes on to discuss a fourth type of prayer, which is not a daily prayer, the prayer of Musaf. We only say Musaf on days where, if we had a Beis HaMikdash, if we still had a temple, we would be offering a special korban. So, for example, on Shabbos, on Sabbath, in the temple, there was a special korban. Because we cannot offer a korban today, we say a special prayer. And the same thing is true on the festivals, in Rosh Chodesh, etc. So that's the substance of the Mishnah. So if you take a look at source 2, the Gemara picks up on this very important language, Tfilas Ha'erev Ein La'Keva. And the Gemara says as follows, Tfilas Ha'erev Ein La'Keva. My Ein La'Keva. What does that mean? Ilema de'ibayu matzle kule laila, if it only meant that you could pray the evening service all night, listnei tfilas ha'erev kol ha'laila, then we should have had a much simpler formulation. The Mishnah ought to have said, tfilas ha'erev kol ha'laila, that you can simply pray all night. But ein la'keva, that's in a way a much more expansive formulation. It might even have implications, says the Gemara, beyond timing. Maybe it's telling us something far more profound. Indeed, Elamai Ein La'Keva. What does Ein La'Keva mean? Not only that there is no fixed time, but a truly shocking statement, Kimanda Amar Tfilas Arvis Rishus. This must be in accordance with the view that the Mariv service itself is a Rishus. How do we normally understand that terminology? What does Rishus mean? So, simply interpreted?
You don't have to do it.
Yeah, it's optional. It's completely optional. If you want to pray, terrific. If you want to watch Johnny Carson, also good. Johnny Carson, you'd have to look for reruns, but for the Tonight Show, you know, it reminds me of, I have a cousin. You know, children are very innocent and delightful. So he has two grandfathers, thank God, who are still living. So one of his grandfathers happens to be a very big scholar. So when he was a very young child, my cousin is now at bar mitzvah age, but when he was a very young child, so his maternal grandfather, he would always see him studying. So naturally, he was the oldest grandchild in that family. So he got it. He, as is often the case, sometimes instead of the grandparent picking the name, the grandchild will pick the name. What are we going to call it? Safta or Babi or Grandma? Depends on the oldest grandchild in many families. So he, being the oldest grandchild in that particular branch of our family, he dubbed this grandparent Torah Saba, because he was always studying Torah. So he just calls him, to this day they call him Torah Saba. Now, his paternal grandfather, a wonderful, wonderful man, who really enjoys television. So he the young child observed this grandfather was always watching TV. So he dubbed him TV Saba. So to this day, in that family, there's Torah Saba and TV Saba. It's a very cute thing. So I always think of this in the context of this machlokas, that if you like, you can if you like, you can daven Mariv. You can be Mariv Saba, but you can also be TV Saba. You could be no prayer. Amazing. Nobody said this about Shacharis or Mincha, but apparently Mariv, you have this option. The Amar of Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Tfilas Arvis, Rebbe Gamliel Omer Chova. Rebbe Gamliel said it was mandatory, just like Shacharis and Mincha. Rebbe Yeshua Omer Rishus, but Rebbe Yeshua said, seemingly, that it was optional. So he had a dispute in the generation of the Tanaim, those who were the authors of the Mishnah, whether Mariv itself is Chova, mandatory, or Rishus, which will translate simply for now, is optional. And not only that, but even in the generation, you'd think it would be resolved. That's an important question. It comes up, well, not every year, not even every 6 months, not every month, not even, it comes up every day. So you should have figured, you'd have figured they would have resolved that. But no, you'll see here, Amar Abaye, who was one of the scholars of the Talmud, said, Halacha kedivrei ha'omer chova, that we rule in accordance with the one who said it was chova, that it was mandatory. V'Rava Amar, and Rava said, Halacha kedivrei ha'omer rishus, that no, the halacha is in accordance with the one who says it's a rishus. It's optional. So not only was it a dispute in the generation of the Tanaim, it was a dispute in the generation of the Amoraim as well. And so we're going to see that this dispute continued to rage for many more centuries, even into the Middle Ages. But before we do that, I want to share with you a story that comes up in the Gemara. If you notice, the different Tanaim who argued over whether Maariv was mandatory or optional were Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. And Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua were the number one and number two rabbis in the yeshiva. Rabbi Gamliel was the head, and Rabbi Yoshua was the number two man. And they had a very contentious working relationship. And oftentimes, Rabbi Yoshua, who was considered the greatest sage of that generation, would disagree with Rabbi Gamliel. And Rabbi Gamliel was a very authoritarian type of figure. And he would force Rabbi Yoshua to concede his position for the sake of unity. So Rabbi Gamliel was a very tough boss. Very, very, very tough boss. And this dispute became the source of a major uproar in the yeshiva, as we're about to see. So Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught us, Ma'isa b'talmid achad shabal lifnei Rabbi Yeshua. One of the scholars came in front of Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua, again, who is of the opinion, as we just saw, that Maariv is a reshus. Amar lo. And so he asked him, Tfilas arvis reshus o chova. Is Maariv obligatory or optional? So Amar lei, so Rabbi Yeshua's response was, reshus. As we learned just a few sentences ago, that it's optional. But this Talmud was a bit of a troublemaker. So if he had stopped here, the story would be very short and probably not worth recording in the Talmud. But somehow this Talmud either was trying to stir the pot a little bit, or I'm not sure what, but Balifnei Rabbi Gamliel, so he chose to go to in front of Rabbi Gamliel, Amar lo, Tfilas arvish reshus o chova. So he asked the same question to Rabbi Gamliel, this student. Amar lo chova. But Rabbi Gamliel responded, it's mandatory. So now the student has gone to two different rabbis and gotten two different answers. So that itself wouldn't be so terrible, but as we noted, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua did not have the best relationship, and the Talmud spilled the beans. So the Talmud says, Amar lo, end of the second line, V'halo Rabbi Yeshua Amar li Rishus, but perhaps innocently, perhaps not so innocently, didn't Rabbi Yeshua tell me a few 5 minutes ago that it was only optional? Why are you trying to make me dive in Maariv, Rabbi Gamliel? Yes. Yeah, of course. Gladys, please.
I thought it was prohibited once you ask a question and get an answer to go to somebody else expecting...
Absolutely. That's why I said I think he was stirring the pot a little bit, especially because I would understand if he, you know, went to one rabbi and got a stricter answer. So then you could forgive him for looking for another rabbi who was going to give a more lenient answer. But this is truly perplexing. He got the lenient answer first, and he went looking for a stricter answer. That always causes trouble. Always causes trouble. That's what we learned from this Gemara. If you get a lenient answer, go home. Unbelievable. Gladys, I agree with you. So Rabbi Gamliel now, is the smoke is coming out of his ears. So Amar lo, Rabbi Gamliel says, Rabbi Yeshua said that? My arch enemy Rabbi Yeshua claims it's only optional? Just wait. Amar lo, hamtein ad sheyichnesu balei treis in the Beis HaMedrash. Wait until all the rabbis come into the Beis HaMedrash. We're going to have, quote unquote, we're going to have a special session today. Chenichnesu balei treisin, when the rabbis came into the Beis HaMedrash, Amar HaShoel v'Shaal, as was the custom in those days, there was somebody who opened up the session with a question, kind of like Congress has their formalities. So in the Beis HaMedrash in those times, somebody would get up and say, the question of the day. Okay, so somebody got up and said, Tfilas arvish reshus o chova. It just so happened to be that day, it was a rigged session, obviously, the person who asked the question just happened to ask, I was wondering, is Maariv optional or obligatory? So Amar lo Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel says, chova. It's mandatory. And then there's silence. Nobody's dissenting. But Rabbi Gamliel is looking for a fight. So Amar Lahem Rabbi Gamliel Lechachamim. So Rabbi Gamliel turns to this room where there's a deafening silence, and he says, "Klum yesh adam shecholek bedaber zeh? Is there perhaps someone here who begs to differ?" So Amar Lahem Rabbi Yeshua. So Rabbi Yeshua, who we know does have a differing view, Rabbi Yeshua says, "Love, not that I know of." Somebody thinks it's optional? I've never heard of that. So Amrlo, so Rabbi Gamliel's response is, again, you see the authoritarian tendencies here. He's not going to accept false unanimity. V'halom yishimcha Amrli Rishus. I have here somebody who told me that you told him that it was optional. Amar Lei, so Rabbi Gamliel says, and because you disagree with me, Rabbi Yeshua, Yeshua, amod al raglecha v'ya'idu b'cha. Rabbi Yeshua, he doesn't even call him by his title, he just calls him Yehoshua, you stand up. It was a way of punishing Rabbi Yeshua, that the whole time he would have to stand, even though he was the greatest sage of the generation. So this is really a very combative thing that Rabbi Gamliel did. Amar Rabbi Yeshua al raglav, the Amar, Rabbi Yeshua said, El male ani chai v'hu meis, Yachol hachai lahafchish esameis. The achshav shani chai v'hu chai, heyach yachol hachai lahafchish esachai. Which is a very poetic way of saying, Rabbi Yeshua said, look, I have to admit it. If one of us wasn't around, I could lie and pretend that that never happened. But the truth is, he's right. Rabbi Yeshua, you see, was a person of great integrity. And he knew that Rabbi Gamliel was going to have it out for him now. But he says, the fact of the matter is that it's true. It's true that I did say Marav was only optional. I did say that. And Rabbi Gamliel says, you know, therefore you have to stand the entire time. So Haya Rabbi Gamliel Yoshe Bedorish, Rabbi Yeshua Omer Al Raglav. Rabbi Yeshua was forced to stand in humiliation the whole time. Ad Shiranenu Kol Ha'am V'Amru L'Chutzpis Atorgaman Amod. Until the rabbis simply revolted. And they said to Chutzpis, who was the one who used to, in those days they didn't have microphones, so when Rabbi Gamliel would say, the Gemara says, Chutzpis would stand up and say, he would bellow out, the Gemara says, so they said, that's it. They pulled the plug on Chutzpis, and they said, that's it. We're not going to have Rabbi Yeshua humiliated anymore. It's over. Amri ad kama netzari v'nezel, how long is Rabbi Gamliel going to go on persecuting Rabbi Yeshua? B'Rosh Hashanah eshtake tzare, last Rosh Hashanah they had a fight. B'Bechoros b'maisi Rabbi Tzadok tzare, in another instance they had a fight. Hachanami tzare, and now he's embarrassing Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua just, you know, has his view. Rabbi Yeshua wasn't looking for a fight. He's of the view that Marav is only optional. Tavin avre, and they removed Rabbi Gamliel from his position. Anybody remember who they replaced him with, by the way? It was a dark horse candidate. They couldn't find, they had to impeach Rabbi Gamliel, so they didn't have they couldn't do a rabbinic search. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who at the time was only, and we know that from Haggadah, because he says, Harei ani kiven shivim shana, right, he wanted to have, but famously, this is also very important, before Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah accepted the position, anybody remember what he said? They asked him to accept it, given the fact that Rabbi Gamliel was impeached. But Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah laid down a very important principle for men, for many, many generations. Another one of the important.
He had to go ask his wife.
He said, I have to go ask my wife. Okay? Right? Because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah knew that if he accepted the job and his wife didn't approve, they would very soon be looking for another head of the yeshiva. Okay? So that's a very important Talmudic principle that we learn. Can't not mention it. In any event, I bring down this Gemara for a number of reasons, but one of them being that I wanted to try and demonstrate just how contentious an issue this was. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua fought over it. Rabbi Gamliel doing most of the fighting, Rabbi Yeshua looking mostly to avoid a confrontation. But Rabbi Gamliel absolutely lost his job over it. Now, I should just note that Rabbi Gamliel eventually got his job back, at least partially. But what we've seen so far, just to take a brief summary, is that there is a dispute about Marav that simply doesn't exist when it comes to Shachris and Mincha. Everybody agrees that Shachris and Mincha are mandatory. But when it comes to Marav, we saw a dispute. There are those who are of the view that it's Chova, Rebbe Gamliel, the generation of the Tanaim, and there are those who are of the view that it's Rishus, that it's optional, Rebbe Yehoshua, in the generation of the Tanaim. But we also saw that in the generation of the Amoraim, if I may remind you, that it was a dispute still. Abaye was of the view that it was a Chova, and Rava was of the view that it was a Rishus. Now, the question is, which view do we accept, Lehalacha? So if you take a look at page 2, what is the accepted practice? Now, as a matter of background, since Abaye and Rava disagreed about this, does anybody know what the general rule is in a machlokas between Abaye and Rava? Who is generally decisive? We have a Talmudic principle here. Outstanding, Gladys. So Rava is usually the decisive view, with the exception of 6 cases that have their own acronym. So if that were true, so then what should the halacha be? If Rava is the decisive, the normative view, generally, what was Rava's view again? Just we can go back to the source just to review. But Rava said, halacha kedivrei ha'omer rishus. Then who would be right amongst the Tanaim? Rabbi Yehoshua. You say Rabbi Gamliel made Rabbi Yehoshua, you know, stand in the whole song and dance and, you know, was fired over it. But then in the end, Rabbi Yehoshua was really right. It's a Rishus. Rabbi Paskins like him. And in fact, that's the majority view. You don't have to look at it inside, but sources 3, 4, and 5, the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam, all Paskin, that fundamentally Marav is a Rishus. Fundamentally, we're going to define what exactly a Rishus means. It's not as simple as we've made it out to be so far. Optional might not be the best translation. But the majority view, the overwhelming majority view, is that Rabbi Yehoshua was correct, that Marav is simply a Rishus, that Rava is decisive, normative, that Marav is a Rishus, and that is, in fact, the Psak Halacha of the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam. Now, like I said, this is the absolute majority view amongst the Rishonim, but there was a reason that I brought down these three views, the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam. Anybody know what the special relationship of these three Rishonim are, these three medieval scholars? Exactly. So what Jakey is saying is that the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who codified Jewish law in the 16th century, so he writes that his three major influences are the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam. And that in matters of dispute, he's going to go with the majority. So if two of them say one thing and the third says a third, so he'll follow the majority. But here you have, amongst the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam, right, unanimous view that Marav is a Rishus. That becomes very, very important, as we'll see. However, when I was preparing this morning, I found a view that I'd never seen before, which is I was leafing around in the Ritva. The Ritva was a student of the students of the Ramban, of Nachmanides, so he's in what's called the school of Chachmei Sfarad, the scholars of Spain. So the Ritva was a Talmud of the Ra'a, who himself was a Talmud of the Ramban. The Ritva lived in the 14th century. And the Ritva has, if it's truly his view, there are some questions about the Girsa. If you take a look at source 6, the Ritva has a shocking statement. The Ritva says as follows. Yesh lifsok, he says, and we should decide that tzfilas arvis chova, that in fact Marav is truly mandatory. It's a chova. And what's his proof? Dehachi mashma mehahi uvda. And we know this from the story that I just read, the story between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua. Dehahu Talmud she'amad b'beis ha-medrash be'oso ma'amid. That student who asked the question, is Marav a rishus? Is it optional or is it a chova? Is it mandatory? V'sha'al tfilas arbis rishus o chova v'amr lo Rabbi Gamliel chova. Rabbi Gamliel said chova. The Amr Lahu Rabbi Gamliel, Lechachamim, Rabbi Gamliel opened the floor and he said, Klum Yesh Adam Shecholik B'davar Zeh? Is there anybody who disputes this? V'lo heishiv echad mehem davar keneged daso. Nobody answered. Ella to honor Rabbi Yeshua, and in fact Rabbi Yeshua responded, to lekaman de poligalav bedavar zeh, that in fact nobody argues. And if nobody argues, then who must be right? Rabbi Gamliel. Now what do people think about this proof? Everybody see it. The Jakey's already shaking his head. Jakey, why is this not such a great proof?
Well, it seems like the reason Rabbi Yeshua consented is just he didn't want to stir up any more controversy. Furthermore, why would he have told the Talmud initially that it was a rishus if he actually agreed with Rabbi Gamliel that it was a chovah?
I'm in complete agreement with Jakey. In fact, in the continuation of the Gemara, Rabbi Yeshua shows that he still believes that it's a rishus. When he stood up and he said, yeah, I can't lie, you know, I really did tell him it was a rishus. If he had retracted that view, he would have said, I told him that, but that was yesterday. Today is today. I'm a new man. I'm a changed man. I'm a tfilas arvis chova man. But he doesn't say that. It's a very strange raya that the Ritva brings, but a fascinating one. A very interesting one. The Ritva is essentially of the view that if Rabbi Yeshua really believed that Mariv was a Rishus, he would have stood up and he went looking for blood. That Rabbi Yeshua would have said, you bet you, Rabbi Gamliel, I disagree, and let's fight it out right here. So it's a very interesting perspective. So what we've seen so far is the following. In the generation of the Tanaim, there was a dispute between Rabbi Gamliel, who said Mariv was a Chova, and Rabbi Yeshua, who said Mariv was a Rishus. We saw in the generation of the Amorayim, that Abaye said Mariv was a Chova, and Rava said Mariv was a Rishus. And we saw in the generation of the Rishonim, in the Middle Ages, that the overwhelming majority say Rabbi Yeshua was correct, because Rava paskins like him, Mariv is in fact a Rishus. And we have one view, the view of the Ritva, who says, no, we in fact be paskin that Mariv was a Chova. So we see a dispute in the 1st and 2nd century, in the generation of Tanaim, a dispute in the 4th and 5th century, in the generation of the Amoraim, and it continues to be a dispute hundreds and hundreds of years later, all the way into the Rishonim, a dispute between the Ritva on the one hand and all the other Rishonim on the other. So let's operate with the overwhelming majority view that Mariv is a Rishus. Now, does that mean, as we said before, that we could choose to be TV Saba or Torah Saba? Does it mean that we can choose? We could either go to Mariv, or put on. Trying to think what's the most popular. Who's the top rated today? Conan got banished to cable, so it can't be him. Is Leno the top rated? Or?
I don't know.
I think okay. So the generally we have a Talmudic principle called the Chazaka, that if somebody last time you checked was in. So the last time I checked, Leno was beating Letterman. Why that is beyond me, but nobody asked. Okay, so the question is, what does Rishus mean? Now, as Jakey said previously, Rishus generally means optional. But what we're going to see here is that in this case, it's really not so simple.
It generally means permissible. In other words, like Rishus usually has a connotation of, you're allowed to do it.
Right.
Something that's not in the realm of chovah or mitzvah.
Exactly.
Even if it did just mean optional, it would be kind of different than its normal connotation.
Yeah, yeah. Though, when you say something is permissible, it almost by definition means that it's in the realm of discretion.
Right.
So that is in fact one view. If you take a look at source 7, we don't have to read it inside, but the Baha'i, who is a very early view, the 9th century, so this is there's a shita quoted in the Me'iri to this effect, that what we mean by rishus is rishus. It's a nice thing if a person chooses to do it, but it's essentially discretionary. Person would like to daven, terrific, but if you don't daven, mariv, no harm, no foul. That's the simple meaning of Rishus. However, perhaps the majority view was that Rishus here does not really mean optional, or as Jakey correctly points out, permissible. Rishus is a relative term. If you take a look at the Rif here, the Rif in Source 8, Benu Yitzchak Alfazi, it's 11th century North Africa, writes as follows: Afilu lamanda amar rishus, even according to the view of Rabbi Yehoshua and Rava, that Mariv is a rishus and not a chova, chova hi delesa, there is no absolute obligation, aval mitzvah isa, it is a mitzvah. Meaning if you daven Mariv, you have fulfilled a mitzvah. So they're buttressing what it means that Mariv is a rishus. It's not just permissible. We can't command you to do it, but if you do it, you fulfill a mitzvah. I'll give you an analogy. So for example, many scholars are of the view that when it comes to women studying Torah, the Gemara says that women are not obligated to study Torah. It's a mitzvah sasei shazman grama. However, if a woman chooses to study Torah, she has fulfilled a mitzvah. She's not obligated. She doesn't have a chova. But there's a kiyum. So this would be a parallel concept. Now the question is, well, if that's really true, that Mariv is a rishus, in the sense that it's not an absolute obligation, but that one does fulfill a mitzvah by praying, well, what does that really mean in practice? And so here we encounter a very important practical difference in sources 9 and 10. Anybody think of a practical difference between saying that it's absolutely a mitzvah if you choose to do it? Not only are you rewarded spiritually for doing it, but you fulfilled a concrete spiritual act. What's the difference between that, the Rif's view, and the view, let's say, of the Baha'i and others, that it's really optional? So it's a very subtle distinction, but the Bali HaTosfos, the Tosfists, who are in the general school of the Rif on this point, namely that it is a rishus in the sense of having some level of mitzvah, it's not completely discretionary, make the following argument. If your choice is between Mariv and TV, since it's a mitzvah, say the Bali HaTosfos, and not just completely optional, you'd have to daven Mariv. The only practical significance of it not being an absolute chova, absolutely obligatory, is if you take a look at source 9. So the Tosfos say, Hadar minan tfilas arvis rishus, Hainu legabe mitzvah acheres vihi overes. That's only a relative term, and it's merely a comparison to another mitzvah that is a passing mitzvah. De'az amina antidcha tfilas arvis mipaneha, aval lechinam ein lo levatla. What we mean when we say it's a rishus is it's only a rishus with respect to another mitzvah that you can only do right now. Meaning, let's say you have a guest that's passing through, and attending to the guest at night will mean that you can't daven Mariv. But if you don't attend to the guest now, you're not going to have a chance to do Hachnasas Orachim later. So what does Tosfos say? In that case, because it's not an absolute chova, you attend to the guest. So Mariv is, in other words, it's everything, it's a chova in every sense, except for the fact that when you have a passing mitzvah, you push off Mariv. And that's what we mean when we say that Mariv is a rishus, that it's nidcha, it's pushed off in the face of a passing mitzvah. So that's one view. That's the view of Tosfos and Brachos and Daf Chav Vav that we read in Source 9. It's also the view of Tosfos and Brachos and Daf Chav Zayin Amud Beis. However, if you take a look at Source 10, we have a somewhat of a more flexible view. This is the Tosfos and Yoma and Daf Pei Zayin. It's also Tosfos and Shabbos and Daf Tes Amud Beis, where Tosfos says, okay, it's not an absolute chova, and we know it's not completely optional, which means that all else being equal, you should daven Mariv. You really should daven Mariv. The only thing is if there's a good reason, you don't have to daven Mariv. So according to Source 9, the first school of thought in Tosfos, a good reason was rather limited. What was it limited to? A mitzvah that you wouldn't be able to do.
But since you have a large window in which you can daven Mariv, you can always do the mitzvah and daven ma'ariv later.
That's a really good point that Gladys is raising. So in practice, according to that first view in Tosvos, you would really almost always have to daven ma'ariv, because unless it was, again, one of those things where, let's say you had to take somebody to the hospital and you had to be there all night. Right? So that's a case, but you're absolutely right. Now we're going to see in source 10 a much more flexible view in Tosvos, that basically what I would summarize is, if you have a good excuse, we'll let you out of Ma'ariv. It's not completely Rishus, as the Bahag would have had it, that if you want to be Torah Saba, great. If you want to be TV Saba, also good. And it's not as strict as source 9, where we said, unless you have not just a good excuse, but I would say a gold excuse, a mitzvah you wouldn't otherwise be able to do, you have to daven Ma'ariv. Take a look at source 10. This is the view of the Ri, one of the prominent Tosvists. The Omari, Nihida Rishushi, in Lavakla Bechinam, uses that same expression as the previous Tosvos, that you cannot be mevatalit, you cannot push it off for no reason. Imlo mipnei shum mitzvah overes, unless you have either, as Tosvos said previously, a mitzvah that you wouldn't be able to do at another time. Oh, shara haimene, de parakama de Shabbos, which means you started to get undressed, de lo mitarchin anlay, v'chein ala al mitaso, or you got in bed. So what are the last two cases? They significantly expand what I would call a good excuse. The first is, let's say you started to get undressed, and you're not in proper attire to daven anymore, and we say, okay, you started to get undressed, we're not going to make you get dressed again. So Gladys, that would expand it considerably, right? Or the Rishalmi, the Palestinian Talmud, has a different case where you already got in bed and you said, oh, I didn't daven Ma'ariv. So in that case, you're going to say, you don't have to crawl out of bed. So there are really two schools of thought within the Tosfists as far as what is the significance of Ma'ariv not being a complete Rishus, as the Bahag had it. We say that Ma'ariv is a mitzvah along the lines of the Rif, even if you say it's a Rishus, we mean a Rishus shel mitzvah. You basically have to do it unless you have an excuse. What are the parameters of having an excuse? So the strict view amongst the Tosfists is the only legitimate excuse is a mitzvah that you won't be able to do at another time. And then the more lenient view is you have to have a good reason, which is either a mitzvah that took your time, or you're already in bed, or you're already not in proper attire. We're not going to make you, at that point, daven ma'ariv. But that, what all of these views share in common, the Rif and the two views in the Balei HaTosfos, is that ma'ariv, when we say it's rishus, we don't mean optional or discretionary. We mean that it is the default position, that you should be davening ma'ariv. However, under various circumstances, we'll give you some flexibility. And as we saw, there are different circumstances. Some stricter, some more flexible. Okay. That's a very important step that we've made. So to review what we've seen so far, we've encountered a dispute as to whether Ma'ariv is a Rishus or Chova to begin with, in the Tanaim, in the Amoraim, in the Rishonim. And what we've done just now is we've said, even according to those who are of the opinion that Ma'ariv is a Rishus, that has two very different definitions. The minority view amongst the Rishonim is that actually means it's completely discretionary, it's up to you. If you daven, great, you'll get schar, you'll get reward for it, but there's no obligation whatsoever. And then there's the majority view who say, no, even according to the one who said it was Rishus, that means that it's a mitzvah, and by default you should be doing it, but we'll give you some flexibility in the case of a good excuse. In other words, you can't say when it comes to Shacharis and Mincha, now I'm already in bed, we'll let it go. Only in the case of Ma'ariv could you say that. Now,
definitely can't say the Shacharis already in bed.
Right. Yeah, that wouldn't work. Now, what I want to try and do in the remainder of the shiur, in the next 5 to 10 minutes or so, is to show how, even though, as we said, the overwhelming majority of Rishonim said that Ma'ariv was a Rishus, they paskin that Ma'ariv is a Rishus, what we see is a fascinating transition over Jewish history. That, in fact, Ma'ariv went from a Rishus to a Chova in two different ways. either through the means of a personal acceptance of Maariv or through the means of a communal acceptance of Maariv. So if you take a look at section 4, these are sources 11 and 12, the Bahag and the Rif are both of the view that, yes, it's true that Maariv starts off as a Rishus, which the Bahag defined as discretionary and the Rif defined as a mitzvah. But what they both agree about is that once a person has started to daven Maariv, meaning he's davened Maariv once in his life, it seems, that at that point he's accepted upon himself as a chova. So once you daven Maariv, that's it. You've accepted upon yourself, and from that point on, it's a chova, and you're obligated to daven not just twice a day, shachros and mincha, but you're obligated to daven Maariv as well. So we have a transition from rishus to chova, from optional to mandatory, triggered by the individual. If you just take a look at source 12, we'll read it inside. V'kaimolan, the Rif says, d'halacha kirava, we paskin like Rava, that Maariv is fundamentally a rishus, which the Rif understands to mean that it's a mitzvah, but it's not mandatory. Miu hani mili hecha delot sali leklal. That's only true if you haven't davened Maariv at all. Aval hecha det sali le letzvilas arvis, once you daven Maariv, kvar shavye ale hachoba, you've accepted it upon yourself as an obligation. And from that point on, it's obligatory. So the question is, you know, what does it mean that you've davened once or you've made a regular habit of it? But the fundamental point here, in both the Bahag as well as the Rif, sources 11 and 12, is that in fact, even though we paskin that Maariv is a rishus, which, as we saw, different Rishonim define somewhat distinctly, the bottom line is that it can go from being a rishus to a chova through the means of personal acceptance. Once a person has decided to daven Maariv, to take, as they say, to take Maariv upon himself, from that point on it's a chova. That's one type of transition between rishus and chova. There is a whole different, and I would argue even more profound transition between rishus and chova, which is not through the means of personal acceptance, but through the realm of communal acceptance. The Rif, the Rosh, and the Rambam, the magic three, who are always the input into Shulchan Aruch, these are sources 13, 14, and 15, all rule that at some point the Jewish community accepted Maariv as an obligation. That even though we paskin like Rabbi Yeshua, that Maariv is a Rishus, which was the view of Rava, and we said the Rif, the Rosh, and the Rambam all agree that that's how we paskin against the Ritva, who says Abaye was right, and Maariv is a chova. Even though at one point it was a rishus, we'll just take a look at the language of the Rif, which is copied by the Rush and the Rambam, ha'idna, but now, by the 11th century, says the Rif, nahug alma l'shavye kechova. It has become an obligation. The community has accepted Maariv as an obligation. So we saw in section 4 is that there are really two distinct routes that Maariv goes from being a rishus to a chova. The first is through the realm of personal acceptance, and the second is the realm of communal acceptance, which is the view of the Rif, the Rosh, and the Rambam, that the Jewish community has accepted Maariv as an obligatory prayer, and that became normative as far as halakha goes. The Tur, who was a forerunner to the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Asher, the son of the Rosh, wrote in the 15th century, this is verse 16, and he added two or three very important words, Rav Alphus, that's the Rif, Kasav de ha'idna kavua chova, that Maariv has been established by the Jewish community and accepted as an obligation, ve'ein levat laklal. Anybody know what those words mean? Ein levat laklal? At this point, it should never be overridden. That all the discussions that we had previously within the view of the Tosfists, well, let's say you have a good excuse. Well, how good an excuse do you need? Does it need to be a mitzvah? Or could you already be in pajamas? Or could you already be in bed? That's all academic. Because from this point on, it was accepted as a chova. All the latitude in terms of one's obligation to pray Maariv, which we discussed within the view of the Bali HaTosfos, none of that exists anymore. And this is in fact normative. This is the view that we accept. The Shulchan Aruch just accepts this as a simple matter. He doesn't even go into it because the conversation was open and closed by the time that we got to the tour. And as we've tried to very thoroughly trace from the Mishnah through the Gemara, through the Rishonim, this dispute between Rishus and Chova was finally settled, that in fact the Jewish community, as a matter of practice, accepted Mariv upon itself as a Chova. But where I want to conclude is with a really fascinating point. When we say that the Jewish community accepted Mariv upon itself as an obligation, does that mean that this whole conversation about Mariv having its roots as Rishus, it started off not the same as Shachris and Mincha. It started off on some level as discretionary, whether that means completely discretionary, according to the Bahag and others in the Rishonim, or it meant that it was a good thing to do and maybe a default position as the Tosfists would have it, but not an absolute obligation, and therefore you could get out of it. Meaning it was different. It was truly different than Shachris and Mincha, which were absolute chova. Mariv was different. So by the time the Jewish community accepted it upon itself, did it just, was that all washed away? You know, for mere legalists to discuss, those who remember way back when Rabbi Yeshua was of the view that it was a rishus? And the answer is no. There are many important echoes of Mariv as a rishus, and I'm going to show three of them quickly. Even though the fundamental question, must we daven Mariv, the answer is yes, it is a chova. The way that we accepted Mariv upon itself, upon ourselves, still reflects its unique halachic history. The fact that it was once a rishus. And this in three ways. The Rambam asks the question, why is it that Mariv, unlike Shachris and Mincha, there's no chazar sashatz? Ever wonder about that? The Shliach Tzibur, the communal representative, doesn't repeat the Shmona Esrei in Mariv. He does so in Shachris, he does so in Mincha, he even does so for Musaf. Does so for Ne'ilah and Yom Kippur, but not Mariv. Why not? The Rambam writes, Eino chozer lihispalo b'kol ram arvis. We don't have chazer sashatz. L'fi she'ein tfilas arvis chova. Because Mariv at its root was not an obligation, lefikach lo yivarech brachos levatala. We don't want extra brachos recited. She'ein kan adam shenischayiv bahem kidei lehotzio yidei chova. So nobody truly has a full obligation, even though the Rambam himself, as we said, is of the view that the Jewish people accepted it upon themselves as an obligation. True, we accepted it, but that was only as far as the question of davening is concerned. But it never was a full chova. It never was accepted to the extent that somebody would need a shliach tzibur to help them fulfill their obligation. And therefore there's no chazar sashatz. The Rambam in source 18 gives us a second area where the fact that Mariv, even though it was accepted upon the Jewish people, by the Jewish people, for the Jewish people, as an accepted practice, that in the end, there's still a difference between Mariv on the one hand and Shachris and Mincha on the other, which is that there's flexible timing. I'm not going to get into all the details here, but in source 18, the Rambam notes that when it comes to Mariv on Friday night, you should daven Mariv a little earlier, before sunset. And when it comes to Mariv on Saturday night, on Motzei Shabbos, you should daven it also a little earlier. And the Rambam just says here, Lefisha tfilas arvis rishus, ein medaktik in bismana. Because Mariv is optional, even though we accepted it upon ourselves, as a chova, we have more leeway when it comes to time. We have flexibility. It's not like Shachris and Mincha, where there are such hard and fast rules. And then a third area is that we generally have the view that, let's say in the morning, we say a special prayer called Yitzur Yisrael Kuma Bezer Sisrael, and we finish Ga'al Yisrael, and we know that you're not supposed to have any break between that and Shmon Esrei. But in Mariv, we have the bracha of Ga'al Yisrael, and then we have a whole long prayer, at least in some communities, which creates a kind of separation between Ga'al Yisrael, between Ge'ula and Tzvila. And Tosfos in source 19 makes the note that the only reason we're allowed to have a break between Geula and Tefillah, which is really a topic in its own right, is because Mariv is a Rishas. Just read it inside. Miu b'seder of Amram Perush, Masha anu omrim kaddish bein Geula l'Tefillah's Arbis. The fact that we could have any separation at all, a kaddish or extra psukim that we recite between the brach of Gal Yisrael and Shmon Esrei, l'ashmina, that is to teach us. Diloba inan mismach geula d'arvis l'tzvila, that we don't need to make geula, the bracha of Gaal Yisrael, adjacent to Shemona Esrei, mishum d'tzvila's arvis rishus. That's to remind us that marv is a rishus. In other words, even though we've accepted upon ourselves as a chova, the structure of marv reflects the fact that it was once a rishus, that you can separate between geula and tzvila. So we said in three ways, even though we've accepted Marv upon ourselves as a community, Marv still bears the hallmark of a Rishus, of something that was once quite different than Shachris and Mincha, and that was later on accepted by the Jewish people. Number one, no Chazaras Hashatz. Number two, that there's more flexibility in terms of when you can pray. You can pray all night, and sometimes you can even pray before the sun sets. And number three, that we can create a separation between Geula and Tefillah. If it was really mandatory, it would have to follow all the rules of mandatory prayer. And one of the cardinal rules of mandatory prayer is no separation between Geula and Tefillah. So I just want to, because we've covered, thank God, a considerable amount of ground, I just wanted to quickly use the schematic on the back to show that it's much more complicated than it really may sound at this point, and to use this as a good chazara. We said when it came to Mariv, there are two views in the Tanaim, in the generation of the scholars, in the Mishnah of the Amoraim, the generation of the scholars of the Gemara, and in the Rishonim, the medieval scholars. There are those who say that it's a Rishus in your right-hand column, and there are those who say it was the Chova. And we'll just, that dotted line in the middle, we'll just keep that in mind. Then the right-hand column is the Rishus, and the left-hand is the Chova. Now, within those who are of the view that it was a Rishus, we said there are two ways to understand Rishus, either completely discretionary, Rishus Gamur, which you see right here, or that it was a mitzvah. It was only a Rishus in the sense that if you had some kind of a good reason not to pray, you didn't have to. So within the track that it's a mitzvah, if you follow down now to the third level, there's the view that it could be Nitcha Rak Al Yidei Mitzvah Overis, the first view amongst the Balei HaTosfos, the Tosfos and Brachos, which that it's only pushed off if there's a passing mitzvah. If there's a mitzvah that you can't let slip by. And then there's a more lenient view, which is that if you have a good excuse, you're already in bed, according to the Yerushalmi, or according to the Gemara and Shabbos and Daf Tesam and Beis, that you started to get undressed, or according to the Gemara and Yom Daf Pei Zayin, which we didn't see, you have to go prepare a meal for Motzai Yom Kippur, people are hungry, you have a good excuse, that's enough. Okay? So that's another thing that we saw. But if you follow the diagonal line, which takes us from the column of Rishus to the column of Chova, you'll note that even according to the majority view, which is that Mariv was a Rishus, it wasn't completely mandatory like Shachris and Mincha were, at some stage it transforms to a Chova. And that can happen in one of two ways. Either through a personal acceptance, which both the Bahag and the Rif spoke about, that once you accept the Marav upon yourself, it becomes an obligation, or through communal acceptance, which the Rif, and in his wake, the Rush and the Rambam, also accepted that at some point the Jewish community ruled that Marav was going to be accepted upon themselves as a Chov. And then if you follow the arrow back, not to make us crazy, or to create a ping-pong-like effect, but if you follow that, even though it became a chova, it still bears the hallmarks of Rishus. Well, that arrow back into the Rishus column, it has tchunot shel Rishus. It has the characteristics or the qualities of a prayer that was once a Rishus, even after we accepted upon ourselves as a chova. And we said that in three ways. Number one, there's more flexibility in terms of its timing. You have all night, and sometimes you can even pray. The Rambam said on Friday nights and Saturday nights, better to pray earlier. Number two, there's no Chazaras Hashatz, because nobody has a true obligation. If somebody had a true obligation, we would need a Shliach Tzibor, we would need a communal agent to repeat it, to help those who aren't familiar. to fulfill their obligation. But since nobody has a full obligation, we don't want to have those extra brachos recited. And then area number three is it doesn't need to follow the rules of an absolutely mandatory prayer. What are the hard and fast rules of mandatory prayer? That you cannot have any separation between the bracha of geula and tefila. And here we dafka, said Rav Amram, Tosus, Daftalan on the base, dafka here, we have a kaddish and we have some sukkim, Baruch Hashem li'olam amen v'amen, to create a separation to remind us, no, even though we accepted Marev upon ourselves as a community, don't think it's the same as Shachris and Mincha. And that's really where I wanted to conclude, and Madera will pick it up next week, is that Marev, even after it became an obligation, it still bears its unique brand of tefillah. It is still different. It's a tefillas reshus even after it was accepted as a chova. And this creates a very poetic and I think very poignant dimension of Marev that we will explore in the coming weeks and months. That Marev is what I like to think of as a grassroots movement. It's the prayer equivalent of the internet donation to a campaign. Marev, to this day, reflects a kind of spiritual initiative on the part of the Jewish people to reach out to their Creator in the night. And that even after it became institutionalized on a certain level, it was somehow important that even while it was institutionalized, it never lose its unique gestalt, which is as a prayer that started off as spiritual initiative, and that it always reflected that. Marev is really a bottom-up kind of prayer, and it's that dimension of Marev as reflecting a kind of spiritual initiative, a call to the Creator in the night, a kind of spontaneous call, not one that's legislated and has as fixed a time. Even after it became accepted, it still bears that unique flexibility, that unique imprint of the spontaneous call in the night. We're going to be speaking about nighttime as a time of greater spiritual awareness, where man, vulnerable in the dark and the cold, seeks out his Creator, and in a certain sense his Creator seeks him out. And this seemingly technical halachic discussion, seemingly legalistic discussion regarding was it a rishus or was it a chova and who says what, is really getting at that core issue, that philosophical point, which is how different is Marev in the end than Shachris and Mincha as a non-institutionalized prayer. And I conclude with those opening words that we read from the Mishnah, that truly tefillas ha'erev ein la keva. Ein la keva not only means, as the Gemara said, that it doesn't have a fixed time, but ein la keva reminds us of another statement of Chazal, that tefillas keva, rote prayer, ein a tefillah. It's not prayer at all. A prayer which it doesn't come from the heart, doesn't come from the depths of one's soul, that's not true prayer. And if there's one prayer that defies keva, that defies monotony and rote and institutionalism and dryness, it's Marev. Tefillas Arev is indeed ein la keva. It defies keva. Its nature always is spontaneous. And that is why it's so worthwhile to discuss Marev and its halachic foundations and, of course, its spiritual foundations, which we'll, God willing, do in the weeks and months to come. And again, this year should be the aliyah for the neshama of Gladys' mother, Shana Blumabas Menachem Mendel.